So this evening, no, it's not this evening. I always seem to make a mistake straight away. this morning, my last talk, I started off by saying I was ordained in 2000, and Parabandha said, "No, you weren't." So mistake over, hopefully. So the talk is, I want to do two things really. I want to try and say something more about, you know, try and add to our discussion of reimagining the Buddha. I'm especially thinking of Subhuti and Bhante's paper, and probably you, like many of us, we've all been discussing that paper very much. So I want to hope by giving this talk it contributes to that discussion. I don't think it adds to it, really. I think it might hopefully contribute to it. So I want to say some things around that first. In a way, I want to do sort of theory first and practice second. And then secondly, I just want to talk about Aloka's rupa. Please turn your mobile phones off. As for duty, I'm surprised at you. You of all people. the main body of the talk really just comes from sort of informal conversations I had on the last order weekend, where I was talking to some friends of mine about my response to the Buddha Rupa, and what I said to them seemed to be helpful. It seemed to help them relate to it. So I, in a fit of enthusiasm, wrote to Lukeshwara saying, you know, it seemed to be helpful to say some things, and then suddenly find myself to be the only person giving a talk on this weekend, which wasn't quite what I had in mind. I was just going to say, well, I like this bit and I like that bit, and sort of share that. But that's actually mainly what I'm going to be doing in the talk. But I want to do those two things. I want to try to continue our explorations of reimagining the Buddha, reimagining our sadhana figure, and just use Aloka's wonderful rupa as an example of that. So in Don Patterson's introduction to Shakespeare's sonnets, he talks about two kinds of readings of poems. And he puts it very clearly. He says that there are secondary readings of poems, and this is the whole area of literary criticism. The secondary readings tend to be interested in a work of art's social, historical, and cultural value. It often compares a work of art to other works of art that's preceded it, that have influenced it. Secondary criticism, secondary readings put it in that critical mode. And then he talks about that there are primary readings. And primary readings are the unique impact that a work of art has on any individual. Yeah? How it meshes with the individual's person's values, concerns, felt experience, the kind of quality of pleasure or displeasure it gives. The primary impact it has on any particular reader, the pleasure particularly that it gives them. And primary readings aren't often articulated, and you don't need to articulate them. You don't necessarily have to articulate them. We've all got them. But you don't necessarily work them up into an articulated response. So what I want to do today is share my primary reading, as it were, of Aloka's rupa. And it's for this primary reading that artists paint and poets write. No artist writes for secondary readings. Yeah? Unfortunately, secondary reading has tended to become the way in which most people assume poetry is to be read, or that most people assume art is to be looked at. I think this accounts for people's insecurity in the gallery. You can see people sort of feeling insecure in front of a painting. You can see them wanting to reach for expert opinion, or read that little notice that says a little bit about it, or carry around your guidebook that tells you what to think of it. This is also true of reading of literature, particularly poems. People feel daunted by them. I used to feel that art was for people who were much more intelligent than me, much more cultured than I was. And I sort of felt slightly intimidated by a poem or a painting. I didn't think my response sort of mattered. So I don't know quite how this has happened in the West, but it's begun to be assumed that secondary readings are the way to read. So even when you teach children now, you teach them about poetry from a secondary reading point of view. You start to say, well, this is a symbol, this is relates to this and this. You don't try to encourage a primary reading. But it's primary readings that the artist is concerned with. That's why they do it. That's why Arlo can make the work. It's why Shakespeare writes sonnets. So it's easy, isn't it, to sort of want to look for expert help all the time. I think this is becoming almost a disease of modern life. For everything you do, you want to look for expert help. And often that isn't a help. Of course, when we're talking about Arlo as Rupa, we've got our own added issue to that, to trying to explore our primary reading of it, in that Arlo as Rupa is an object of devotion, not a work of art. At least not a work of art in the way we've come to think of works of art, which are especially works of art seen through the lens of secondary readings, if you see what I mean. And what secondary readings tend to do, they tend to favour abstraction, detachment, intellectualism and analysis. A secondary reading tends to make you step back from the work, especially step back from your immediate physical and emotional response to it, to analyse its place in culture and society, to analyse its relationship to other work. So in that sense, if it's right that secondary readings have become the de facto way of reading art in the West, then Arlo's Rupa is not a work of art in that sense. I've not been able to think through the difference, actually, between an object of devotion and a work of art. I was talking to my friends about it, and I think there is more to think about that, but I haven't got round to that yet. But it's not a work of art. Arlo's Rupa is not a work of art in the way we've come to assume works of art, which is very much tied in nowadays with secondary readings, and this sort of instinct to look for expert help, to look to the academy to help you with your reading of things. So one of the dangers of talk like this is to give you the wrong eyes, if you see what I mean, to talk about Arlo as Rupa in such a way as you step back from it and analyse it is as an object of art in a world of objects, if you see what I mean, in comparison and so on. So I want to really try and avoid that if I can, which is why I just want to share my, as much as I can, as just my primary reading to it. Because I've, you know, been involved in art, it will involve some secondary reading, but it's mainly my response to it. And I wanted to emphasise this primary reading because I just want to talk about my individual response to Arlo as Rupa. I'm not trying to say what you should think about it, how you should feel about it. I'm not trying to say this is how a Sri Ratna Buddhist should feel about art or Arlo as Rupa. I'm just saying how it touches me, how it strikes me, what it sparks off for me. I'm not insisting that it does the same for you. In fact, sometimes it's better. Primary readings are better if you vehemently disagree with someone's reading. Hopefully, at least, it makes you look again at the image or the poem and clarify your own primary reading, if you see what I mean. Quite often, I think that's valuable, that you think, no, that's definitely not the case. You know? So you don't need to... It's one of those lovely talks where you don't need to agree with me at all. You can just be infuriated by my reading and insist on your own primary reading, and that would be terribly good. Yeah? You don't have to share that with me. yeah. Yes, and as I was saying, I'm also hoping that my talk about Arlo as Rupa will communicate something about reimagining the Buddha, or I think one way of looking at Arlo as Rupa is as a kind of essay in that reimagining the Buddha, a kind of wonderful essay in that. And when I think of this, I'm wanting to tread a path between you know, the formal sadhana as it's come down to us, and you know, another sort of thing coming in, which is about, you know, finding your own illumined image. I want to try and tread the path between the two. At worst, the formal sadhana as it's come down to us can mean that we try to corral our imagination into a preset form which we have no emotional resonance with. I think this is what can happen at worst. So you end up with a set image, with a set of meanings, with a set procedure for how to go through that set of meanings, if you see what I mean. I think that's a great danger, isn't it, of sadhana practice. You end up with this sort of template, and you have to go through it in this way, and these things have to happen, and that has to have this response, and you can read off what each response is supposed to have. So you've got that danger on one side, and then you've got this other danger of this more personal approach with coming up with your own illumined image. So you end up with a swan's wing reflected in water, a leaf, or of course Kylie Minogue. I can't help feeling some of us will move quickly in that direction. So having done the Padmasambhava sadhana now for many, many years, I got to the point, I think, about 15 years after I took it up. I'm not very good at numbers anyway. Somewhere around that, at some point in practicing the sadhana, I got to the point where I just simply couldn't do it anymore, where the set image and its set meanings, and Padmasambhava is kind of loaded down with set meanings to a degree that's at times almost choking, that sort of set image with set meanings just seemed too literal for me. Even actually slightly absurd. I've been experiencing this in my sadhana just recently. If I try and bring the image forward in its sort of, you know, given form, I find it slightly absurd. Absurd is not quite the right word, but something along those lines. Yeah. But then when I've been working with just not having an image, I so often just feel rather lost in this kind of knit your own illumined image. You know, I sort of don't know what to do. It all feels a bit too subjective, a bit too blurred. And at the moment, and it is possibly at the moment, because these things change, don't they? For one moment, the received image is extremely powerful, then it seems not to be, then it comes back again. I've had times where I've just gone through the sadhana exactly as I used to when I was younger, and it's been, you know, that's what I've needed to do. At other times, I've let go of the image altogether. Of course, most of the time, I'm just distracted, and neither of those rather grand-sounding statements really count. Anyway, that's another matter. I've come to think, anyway, that at the moment, the valuable imaginative terrain is between these two extremes of the given image and this kind of find your own illumined image. And I think Alokas Rupa, amongst many things, exemplifies what can happen between those two possibilities, between the given image and the sort of created one. I know Dharmarati has been talking about this tension as a relation, analogously in poetry, where you get, you know, the form, like a sonnet form, getting handed down through the ages from Spenser and so on onwards, and then you get that meeting the individual inspiration of the poet. And I mean, the sonnet form is a good example because it's still very alive in contemporary poetry now. You have people like Anne Carson, who does these incredible experimental sonnets, which you can still just about see are sonnets. I mean, only just. But, you know, that connects her right all the way back to the great exemplars of the sonnet. So you, at best, you get this incredible spark of energy between tradition and individual inspiration. I've come to think that is where the imagination might lie, between form and play, in a way, between tradition and innovation, between the past and the present. And I think what Dharmarati is saying there is very true and a very good analogy. The other thing for us, of course, which I think adds to our need to reflect about this, is that we're part of a common order. So it's not quite like the sonnet, if you see what I mean. the analogy slightly breaks down, because we're part of an order and a movement, a distinct Buddhist tradition. So we're part of a public world. So our forms need to be public, as it were. They need to be shared. We couldn't just have some people working within the sonnet form and then some people doing a sestina. They'd have to be shared. Look up sestina. So there's this whole issue that we're a public. Our forms need to be public. They're shared. So I think that probably that's what Bhante is getting at when he would like, when he says, or so I heard from Subhuti, that he wants us to stick to the sadhanas that he's given, or to the sadhanas he's practiced himself. And that's to do with, I think, the fact that our forms need to be shared. There's something very important about that. There's much more to say about that, but that's as much as I got to. We need a language of shared forms, just as we need a shared language, a shared metaphysical language. So the other aspect I hope to bring out in talking about Alokas Rupa, these are all in a way introductory remarks before I actually get onto the meat, as it were. The other aspect I want to bring forward is the special role of the artist in mediating our shared imaginative life. You know, the special role of the artist in mediating our shared imaginative life. And I think Alokas' work and other painters in the movement, and particularly I'm struck by Chintamani's paintings recently. Jnanavarch has a wonderful Manjugosha by Chintamani. And we sit in Jnanavarch's room every Sunday evening for our chapter meeting. And 2.5 years later, I'm still finding myself inspired by that painting. I'm still finding myself enriched by the painting. So actually, I think for a long time, artists in the movement have been mediating our shared imaginative life. And I sort of want to sort of bring that up a bit, because it can easily go a little bit unnoticed. This room itself is a mediation of our shared imaginative life. And I was thinking about this, and as I always do, I talked to my friends about this, talked to Jnanavarcha about this, and we went out together to see, to listen to some Beethoven sonatas. And I remember we were sitting near the back in the cheap seats, and Jnanavarcha was shocked because at the last moment I insisted we all rush forward to the expensive seats that weren't taken. I think it's all right. I think it's one of those moments you get in the concert hall where it all, you know, it all completely makes sense. And the pianist, the French pianist, who I don't know, he played the Moonlight Sonata, and now, you know, one knows the Moonlight Sonata perhaps too well, and it's become a cliché. It's become a cliché in our mind. It itself, of course, isn't a cliché at all. And this pianist just played it again, and I was just struck by the sheer beauty of the piece. I mean, all the sonatas we were playing were, quite incredible, really, monumental. And afterwards on the tube back, we were talking about that, and just talking about, in a way, analogously, it would be like, you know, this whole idea of coming up with your own illumined image could just be like saying, okay, let's think of a really lovely bit of piano music. Just see if you can imagine a beautiful piece of music, and probably you'd come up with something fairly trite, wouldn't you? Something sort of cheerful and fairly trite. You couldn't have come up with Beethoven's sonata. You probably could not have done that. Our imaginative reach is usually so poor, really. And the great role of the artist has been to reveal imaginative reach well beyond our own. And you really felt, I really felt that evening listening to Beethoven, that I could never have imagined that music. Beethoven had to discover it for me, and then I could reach it. But he had to discover it for me. Incredible, isn't it, that it's still being played in concert halls today. He had to find it. He had to reveal beauty to me, and then I could respond to it. I couldn't have come up with anything like it myself. So that really is the role of the artist. The role of the artist is to stretch your imagination into a realm of beauty that you couldn't have done yourself, that my instincts of beauty would be too self-referenced, too small. They tend to be cliched. And one of the great things that artists do is they constantly break cliches, the sort of dead language of cliché. That my own imagination would be too small, too predictable in a certain sense. It's very difficult with great works of art to get past their patina of age, like with the Moonlight Sonata. It's sort of been built into Western culture now, and has got this sort of patina of age. But at the time, it must have been incredibly shocking, just as Shakespeare at the time was shocking. Something new, something unprecedented, a new seeing, a new hearing. So this is what artists are trying to do. They're trying to reveal the imaginative world to us so that we can rise up to it. This is their mediating function, traditionally. Of course, it's a very, very tall order, and very few artists ever manage it in any age, at any time. Very few people are read after their lifetime, as it were. Very few painters are looked at after they finish painting. But this really is the role of the artist. And, so that those are my introductions. And hopefully what I want to do now is try to show all that in how I want to talk about Arlica's Rupa. And what I hope to do in the rest of the talk is show and not tell. The great sort of adage that people talk about art, show and not tell. That's what people say in writing groups about poems, you need to show and not tell. But that is what art does, is it shows and not tells. Yeah? Any truly imaginative work of art has all the power of a worked out argument. It's just as tough as a worked out philosophical argument. People tend to think that imagination is kind of softer and fluffier, that you have sort of hard worked arguments, and that imagination is just like a bit of colourful colour and movement on the side, so it's something much softer and fluffier. But actually any work of art worthy of that name is just as tough, just as rigorous, even as intellectually rigorous, as a philosophical argument, but it does it in images. It shows that rather than tells that. So Schopenhauer, for instance, thought that Kant was the greatest mind in philosophy and Shakespeare was the greatest mind out of philosophy. And he said that Kant sort of looked around and worked out what it meant and wrote what it meant, and Shakespeare just sort of looked around and said, "This is what I see." You know, it's a direct revelation. Schopenhauer thought the arts do in concreto what philosophy does in abstracto. So philosophy uses the language of abstract thought, and art shows. So that's really where show and tell comes from. Philosophy tells, art shows. So I just want to sort of go through the steps of my relationship with this wonderful figure, and hopefully by that, help us see it more deeply. So first of all, I saw it in progress in the studio. I went to visit Arlica in his studio, which is in itself a remarkable experience. You know, when you come out, there should be a decompression chamber, really. You know, to be ejected onto this little suburban road after being in his studio is really just too much. You know, you should have to sit down and take some deep breaths or something. I mean, it really is like going into this other world. Never mind the studio, the kitchen, into the garden. go there. You know, it should be a place of pilgrimage in itself. Anyway, I went to the studio, and there it was in the studio. It was the figure was almost was complete. It wasn't painted particularly; the bits of it were painted. It was in progress. It seemed to fill the studio, and I sat down and looked at it and talked to Arlo a bit, and I had no idea what to make of it. That was my main feeling. I had no idea what to make of it. I couldn't think of anything. I just sort of said, ah. You end up with, it's big. It's filling the studio. You know, you can't think of anything to say. I just really didn't know what to make of it. I didn't know whether I liked it or not. I just, there it was. It was a fact, without doubt, but I didn't know what to make of it. Actually, I think there's something very valuable about that kind of response, and I want to come back to that in a minute. The second thing that struck me when I was talking to Arloka about it in the studio was that it had no aura. I said, you're going to put a head aura on, aren't you? Or a body aura, or one of the two. And he said, oh, no, no. And I thought, oh, crikey. I was quite slightly shocked by that. And I think I must have discomforted Arloka, because he later did actually build, I think, a head aura and tried it out and then got rid of it, quite rightly. And we ended up, as we often do, getting into arguments about the Renaissance. And he was talking about the problem of the halo in the Renaissance. So the halo works wonderfully in the before the Renaissance, because you get these sort of full-on figures and they have this lovely circle behind them. Works perfectly. As soon as you end up with a desire to picture something more like in naturalistic space, where they can turn into semi-profile or profile, what do you do with a halo? You can see artists like Masaccio and these early Renaissance masters trying to work that out. You sort of think, what do they, you know, so does it stay round or does it come round? you know, what do you do? Does it like a radar behind you? You know, what kind of thing is a halo? And some, I think there's a Masaccio where Christ's halo is just like a straw boater. You know, it's just sort of, he's also, okay, well, let's just say it's a disc then. And it just doesn't work. You can see why it was dumped very, very quickly because of those kind of artistic problems. So that was my first experience of the Rupa. And then I came to Padmaloka to meet the team here, and Lakeshwar very kindly took me into the shed. Don't worry, folks. This is a cleaned-up movement. And he's not that kind of guy. I am, but he's not. Anyway, I promised myself not to make any jokes like that. we took me to the shed. Long story. I shouldn't have said this. It distracted me. Anyway. And too late. And there it was in the shed, wrapped up in blankets. So he, you know, said, "Do you want to have a look?" And I took the blankets off. And I found it a really strange experience. There I was in the shed, just in the garden there, with this figure that, you know, in the midst of the shed, that's had all the blankets taken off it. And again, I just didn't know what to make of it. I mean, it was added just by the strange juxtaposition of being in the shed. Strange figure in the shed. Something really strange about it, something unfamiliar, something mysterious, something quite new to me. I really didn't know what to make of it. And I really want to value that experience of not knowing what to make of it. I think there's something artistically important about that, and I think even more so there's something spiritually significant about that. And I want to come back to that at the end. But that this sense of, I don't know what to do with this figure. I think we need to have a much more discipline of staying in the I don't know what to think about this. I think we far too often rush to have opinions, probably about almost everything. We far too often rush to intellectualism, to analysis, to abstraction, rather than just staying in, I just don't know. I don't know what to make of it. I think there's something much more valuable about I don't know what to make of it than any of our sort of opinionating. It's much more important to stay with that strange, discomforting feeling of what is this? What is this in front of me? I think that's a very invaluable and important experience. So afterwards, I started to think about my sense of disorientation. This magical experience, almost like this Spielberg-like experience of going into this shed and seeing this incredible thing, this incredible figure. And part of my disorientation with it is that it didn't fit with my store of images. I couldn't find a reference to it. We've all got a kind of catalogue of Buddhist images in our head, haven't we? We've got Buddhist images from around the world, that great coffee table book in our head. And somewhere with images, we try and fit them into that. So you sort of instantaneously flick through your you know, Buddha images from around the world, and you try and find out where it fits. And I did that, and it didn't fit anywhere. It certainly doesn't fit with Tibetan images at all. And the images of Tibet that come down to us from Tibetan art are the spiritual vernacular that we've habitually fallen back on. And we seem to have done it more and more, if we'll just keep falling back on that kind of imagery as being the spiritual thing, that things that are spiritual look Tibetan. I think it's become a bit of a habit with us. But it doesn't fit that at all. It's slightly reminiscent of Chinese and Japanese rupas, but not very much so. Not enough for me to feel comforted by that relationship. So it didn't fit my Buddhist catalogue at all. But also, to me it seemed a new Buddha image, quite new, one that I had no internal references for. I couldn't fit it. And I think there's something very valid about that experience. And I think even something very spiritually important. At the same time, the figure didn't fit my storehouse of Western images. You know, I went to art school, I'm a bit of an arty person, I've read the history of art, you know, and so on, and it didn't fit with my history of art, with my Gombrich, as it were. It didn't fit into that catalogue. Especially it didn't fit with Greco-Roman Renaissance, that tradition. So the accepted mode in the West for portraying spiritual, heroic, or godlike figures has, for centuries, been Greco-Roman, going all the way back to Greek art, that then coming forward into Roman art, that being rediscovered and reanimated in the Florentine Renaissance and then spreading out from there, one great tradition throughout the West. And that's been our primary vernacular when it comes to talking about spiritual, heroic, or godlike figures. Until recently, if you wanted to build a bank or a council office or something that you wanted to look important, trustworthy, they could look after your money, they'd be secure, nothing would happen to them, they were wealthy. What you did picture that was to put a Roman portico on the front of the building, wasn't it? That's why so many banks have got that classic long triangle with all those columns in the front, is to say secure, timeless, dependable, stable, classical. Yeah? And that's been the sort of mode pretty much until fairly recently. So you've got this sort of image of the spiritual in the West, which one of its primary associations in the West, I think, is with kingship and the whole history of the relationship between kingship and the spiritual and God and so on. So you've got this long question of the classical, which evokes order, beauty, stability, effortless power, timelessness and so on. And people nearly always reach for the Greco-Roman Renaissance line to express that. And Arloka's Rupa seems to me to reject all that, even to be a repudiation of all that. And personally, I think this is a key to why some of my friends find it uncomfortable. And I think there is something uncomfortable about it, actually, and I think that's a good thing. It's not conventionally beautiful, I don't think, at least not in this Western classical sense, which we've so got used to as to think that is beauty, if you see what I mean. We've so got used to the Greco-Roman Renaissance thing that it goes all the way up into modern photographs, and all paint photographs of models, those beautiful black and white photographs of models are really just reiterations of the Greek ideal of beauty. So it's not conventionally beautiful in this classical sense. In a way, I think that Arloka's Rupa is actually an anti-classic, if you see what I mean. There's so much, the more I thought about it, it seems an anti-classic. So it doesn't follow classical Olympian proportions, and I want to say a bit more about that in a minute. It doesn't follow the heroic naturalism passed down to us from the Greeks, the sort of athlete god. It doesn't follow that tradition. It's not naturalistic. So one of the important things to grasp about the figure, it's not naturalistic. And especially this becomes an issue with the face. We want the face to be an Apollo-like classical Greek face, if you see what I mean. And this isn't. The features are very large, which is very anti-classic. Features in Greek work are extremely refined and very, very beautiful. They're certainly not large. Interestingly and strangely for me, from my art background, is the painter in the West that most reminds me of is Poussin. And Poussin is a classicist. I mean, I don't suppose for a moment that Arlauca is influenced by Poussin. I think he's trying to repudiate that. But what Poussin did, who is a kind of great late classicist, he sort of took on the Renaissance mode and sort of polished it to an extremely high gloss. Often people find his work intellectual and cold. I think it's rather wonderful, but there has always been that criticism of him. But interesting, later on in his painting career, he painted the hands and the faces of the figures in his paintings bigger and bigger. So they become slightly cartoon-like later on, in the modern sense. And that was because Poussin was an extremely devout Catholic, I think a Catholic, anyway, extremely devout Christian, and he wanted you to read the paintings like you would read the Bible. So he wanted you to be really clear about what each figure was saying and representing. So if they pointed, he increased the size of the hand, the eyes and the mouth and the nose are increased in size. And there's something about that with this figure that Arlauca's anti-naturalism is trying to get you to read the face much more deeply from every part of the room and from further away, just as Poussin was with his paintings. But even the materials that Arlauca uses are anti-classic. So he uses paper, he uses cardboard even, he uses sacking on the robes. Most artists would have wanted to make a rupa like this to look as much like stone or bronze as possible. Because again, that's in the classical mode. That then refers you back to these rather comfortable, well-established roots in the West about what spiritual godlike figures should look like. They should be beautifully proportioned. They should look like stone or wood or bronze or something. So even Arlauca's materials, particularly when you start thinking about the cusagrass and so on, are anti-classical. I'm not saying that the figure doesn't have dignity. It obviously does. I want to say something about that in a minute. But the art is anti-classic. And I think this anti-classicism, as I see it, works both artistically and spiritually. It's got artistic significance, which for some of you will be interesting, for some of you it won't be, but more importantly, it's got artistic significance. Spiritual significance. So artistically, it's part of Arlauca's passionate rejection of the Renaissance. This is, we have these sort of discussions. Every time I go there, we seem to end up talking about the Renaissance, and he sort of hammers me into the ground. Arlauca feels a passionate rejection, I think, of the alienated, fixed single eye of Renaissance perspective, which has become the dominant mode in the West. And this is a valid criticism of Renaissance work, that what you have to achieve that marvellous proportion and perspective is a fixed, unmoving single eye, which you then can create this static world. And I think Arlauca feels, and I think he feels this very deeply, that that's alien to the spirit of Buddhism, to have this fixed, godlike single eye ordering the world around a single point of the self, if you see what I mean. He feels that's quite alien, I think. I might be putting words into his mouth, but from my discussions with him, he feels that's quite alien to the Buddhist vision. I think he would even say it's alien to human life. It's had a negative effect on human life. And it's interesting for me, at least, you know, for me, the great moment in art is just at the start of the Renaissance, where the spiritual value of the figure is held in equipoise with a new naturalism. People like Masaccio, people like, I can't think of the rest now. You know, that what you get as it goes on is this obsessive concern with naturalism and a falling away, I think, of spiritual significance. The godlike figure has become more and more an essay in how to get proportions right than how to communicate spiritual experience. And I think there is something valid in that. And Arlauca feels that, I think, very, very deeply. And he'd go much further than that. He'd want to then talk about cubism and so on, which is, again, is a bit repudiation of that classical thing. But I think spiritually, I think it's also something very, very important spiritually. I think it's a figure that communicates grandeur and calm, but it does that by repudiating this sort of Greco-Roman ideal. And I think one of the values of that is that ideal very easily becomes effete. And you see this particularly in Pre-Raphaelites, that tendency to polish and buff up the figure into this godlike figure easily becomes effete, even fey, and you end up with this thin, narrowly heroic ideal, a kind of idea of heroic, a sort of thin heroicism, a thin idea of beauty. I think that's built into that tradition a bit, is it can easily go that way. It becomes effete, it becomes homoeroticized, it becomes narrowly heroic, a kind of idea of beauty and divinity rather than an expression of it. There's something inherently, there's a tendency in that tradition to clean everything up, to tidy everything up. And that goes completely against Arloka's human and artistic instincts. I'm saying all this, but that's not to say that tradition is dead or that there's nothing to be gained from that. If anything, I'm more of a Renaissance tradition of myself, you know, temperamentally. So I'm not arguing really against it, but they are justifiable arguments against it, but there are also great things in that tradition. If anything, I'm more drawn to the Renaissance tradition myself. So I'm not sort of trying to disparage it. Anyway, so there were my first sightings of it. I saw it in the studio, didn't know what to make of it. I saw it again in the chair, didn't know what to make of it. Didn't fit my catalogue of images, didn't fit my Western catalogue of images. And then that made me brood on this anti-classicism of the figure. But none of that, seeing it in the shed, seeing it in the studio, none of that prepared me for seeing it here. That was the thing that really surprised me. So often when you see something, when you see it in situ, it's sort of the same thing. You know, and it's nice to see it in situ, but nothing changes. Whereas I felt something really significant changed when I first came and saw it here. Nothing really prepared me for the shock of first coming in and seeing it. The first thing I noticed is that the figure almost seemed to push me back out of the room. I don't know whether anyone else felt that. I just rounded this corner, and it was as if something from the figure was pushing me back out of the room. Very interesting experience. I don't know whether anyone, I hope other people had it. But I was going in, and it was like something was kind of pushing me out back, you know, pushing me out. I had this palpable feeling, and it wasn't a thought. Of course, I've translated it later on, but it wasn't a thought. But a palpable feeling that the room belonged to the Rupa. Excuse me, a palpable feeling of that. Quite a remarkable achievement in itself. Not that I thought that. This sense of being pushed out of the room was because the room now belonged to the Rupa. Now, like any sculptor, Arloka knows very well that the test of a great sculptor, a good sculptor, a significant sculpture, is that it always looks bigger than it is. What sculptures do is they work with something in such a way as to animate the air around them, it seems. They do something to the atmosphere around them, and they always look bigger than they are, and often when you go back and look at them, you're slightly perplexed that it's smaller. I remember again with Jan Avoncha and my friends going to Florence and seeing Donatello's David, and it's much smaller than I thought. And when I remember it, it's much bigger, you know. That's what sculpture does, it animates the air around it. But of course, we're not talking about a work of art in this way, we're talking about an object of devotion. So this has a much more profound spiritual significance than merely animating the air around them. Miraculous though that is, actually, when you come to think of it. How can an object animate a space around it? So I felt, entering this wonderful shrine room, I felt a real physical sense that this was the Buddha's room. This was the Buddha's vihara, which is, after all, what the shrine room originally was. And that, for me, made sense of this sense of being pushed out of the room. Because the fact that this was the Buddha's vihara, this is the Buddha's dwelling place, felt like a challenge. This is where the Buddha lives, and am I fit to live here with him? Am I fit to dwell here with him? Can I really sit here and do my meditation with him? It felt to me a challenge. Was I really able to share the space with him? Wonderfully evoked and extremely important for all of us. For me, this is the most significant spiritual aspect of the Rupa, that this is his room, that this is the Buddha's vihara, and are you fit to join him? Am I fit to join him? Now, I think this sense of the Buddha's presence, of the Buddha's vihara, along with, I think, the feeling of challenge, even the feeling of being confronted by the figure, is achieved in many ways, and each adds to the whole. You can never get to the end of it, because artworks are a whole. You can never really break them apart. Again, Don Patterson says that a really great poem has a sort of cohesion of one word. Everything echoes into itself, so you can't really tease it apart. But I want to just look at some of the elements which I think achieve that. So the first thing to say is that Buddha rupas, and this is Arloka's point, and I'm sure this is true, they derive from low relief. So the earliest Buddhist art was, you know, low relief. So you've got flat pieces of stone with figures carved into it, coming out of the stone somewhat. And, you know, gradually over time, the Buddha figure sort of comes out more and more. You can see this in Michelangelo's early reliefs. You know, the figures gradually sort of pop out of the relief, if you see what I mean. Buddha figures, you can see even now, are clearly derived from the relief. So if you buy a traditional Tibetan rupa, they've nearly always got no back to speak of. Sometimes the lotus just doesn't even go all the way around. But even when they do, it's very cursory. They've really not got a back. And that's because they've just popped out of a relief. And they're still remembering their home, as it were. You know, that's why the aura is often used as part of the relief. Arloka's rupa is completely broken with that. Yeah. It's broken out of the relief. Actually, Arloka's rupa has got a rather beautiful back. I remember in the studio, he turned it around. It's got a very, very beautiful back. And it sits out from the wall. And the effect, of course, is that the Buddha is in the room, not part of the room, not part of the architecture of the room. When you have them against the wall with those auras about them, they become like a carving in a niche, or again, the figure in a relief. So they become safely part of the room. You're in the room, and they're sort of part of the architecture of the room. By doing what Arloka has done, it's betrayed that and made it much more uncomfortable that the Buddha is now in the room with us. He's not part of the room. And of course, this coming into the room is greatly enhanced by the fact that he's not sitting on a lotus. I think that brings that out very, very strongly. A lot more you could say about that, but probably that's all I'll say. And this sense of confrontation, which I think is the most spiritually valuable part of the rupa, along with so many other things. And when I say confrontation, I don't mean something crude. I don't mean something crudely aggressive in any sense, even allegorically. This sense of confrontation is again enhanced by the anti-classical proportions of the figure. He's doing something very, very clever here. I don't think... And when you talk like this, by the way, you're not talking about how it feels like to make it. Arloka is very, very straightforward as an artist. He's an artist all the way down to his toes, so he just makes something. He doesn't... He's not having a literal argument. It's in his hands. So I'm not saying this is what he thinks consciously. But what's one of the things that's striking about this anti-classical proportion is it's not composed around the geometries of a triangle, yeah, which is a great classical sort of shape. Or rather it is, but it distorts them. A triangle as a shape has this wonderful stability, this wonderful security, and therefore this wonderful sense of being comforting, if you see what I mean. The triangle evokes both the mountain grandeur and the unshakability of the mountain, but also it evokes the mother's lap. You know, all you need to do is look through your catalogue of Renaissance paintings, from Raphael's Wonderful Holy Families to Leonardo's great cartoon in the National Gallery, and they're composed wonderfully around this hugely stable triangle, which is both dynamic and wonderfully comforting. I mean, the Renaissance painters really did this to the nth degree. And Arloka's rupa subtly evokes that tradition, but betrays it at the same time. It evokes that convention and betrays it, at least for me. And he does that by extending the topmost point of the triangle, just slightly. Yeah? So there's something more columnar about the rupa, something more of a column about the figure, and this has got a very different significance to the triangle. It's more challenging, it's more martial even, it's more erect. It very much reminds me of the Buddha of the Pali Canon. I was very struck recently when I was here leading a study on the transcendental principle of the figure that you meet of the Buddha in Bante's survey. It's not at all a sweetened figure. It's not at all a Christ-like figure. It's really rather a terrifying, uncompromising figure. And you see this again and again in the Pali Canon, don't you? Ratnagosha was pointing out a sutra where a famous Brahmin comes to talk to the Buddha who's famous at arguing with people so that they end up shaking and sweating. And then the Buddha gets into a discussion with him, and lo and behold, by the end of the discussion, this Brahmin is shaking and sweating. And the Buddha doesn't leave it at that. He just says, okay, so you're very famous for getting people to shake and sweat. Who's shaking and sweating now? Am I shaking and sweating, or are you? You know what I mean? It's incredibly, I mean, it would be terrifying, wouldn't it, to meet someone quite like that. And I think what Arlok has done here is brought that Buddha, the Buddha of the Pali Canon, very much alive, and that becomes very much part of a whole discussion about reimagining the Buddha. In fact, I think there's something of the lingam about Arloka's rupa. This is what it sort of echoes to me. There's something of the erection about it, the lingam in the ancient sense. And it's to do with this columnar aspect of the figure, but it's coupled with the feeling that the rupa evokes something ancient, something pagan even, something primordial, something earthly. And the lingam has got all of those feelings. It's something ancient, something earthy, something primordial. And of course this idea of something ancient, something primordial is developed by the kusha grass at his feet, by the sacking that he uses on the robes, and by the robes themselves, which evoke for me a serpent-like energy, dragon-like, naga-like energy, which of course makes me spin off into, think of how in the West we wanted to kill the dragon, think of how we've demonised the snake. And what Arlok has done in this rupa is he's brought the snake back, he's brought the dragon back, but recreated in this this incredible energy of the robes. It's as if the robes are showing the energy of the figure, just like the beautiful gold and silver adornments of jewels on the bodhisattvas show the bodhisattva's inner riches. What you see in the robes is an evocation of the energy within that kind of stillness, this python-like energy that the robes evoke, but also this low centre of gravity that the figure has. It's very, very noticeable, I think, that the centre of the figure seems to be just behind the hands, just at the navel. The energy of the figure seems to swirl out behind those massive workman's hands. It's a wonderful way of reimagining this question, reimagining the Buddha, that there's something confrontational about him. He's still obviously with his serenity and calm, but it's not a sort of trivialised calm and serenity. It's not a sweetened one. Really almost impossible to pull off. And I think all of those elements help that. The anti-classicism, the materials, the low centre of gravity, how he's done the robes, the columnar aspect of the figure, the betrayal of the triangle and so on. They're all part of this one thing that the rupa is evoking. And then, of course, there's this mystic tree behind the Buddha. Now, I think this is Padmajoti's innovation. I remember talking to them about it in the studio. And when Arloka told me about their plans for it, I had real qualms. One tries not to show them because it hadn't been made then. But just talking through with the idea of this tree, I thought, oh no, that won't work at all. My fear that it would become like a stage set, if you mean. So you end, eventually you'd end up having to have deer spotted about and all that sort of thing. That's what worried me. So again, when I came in, I was just so deeply struck by the tree as well as the whole. As I say, it's not really the tree and the Buddha, it's the whole thing. It's one thing. In a way, the whole room is one thing. It's the Buddha's room. But just to say something about this wonderful Bodhi tree, the Buddha's aura has been, as it were, given to the tree. Incredible thing to do. So the halos aren't there, the auras, the body aura, the head aura aren't there. All of that's been given to the tree. And this, as often in significant art, it solves problems on all kinds of levels on the same at the same time. One of the exciting things about art, at its best, is it can solve all kinds of problems, often including very simple practical problems like hiding a drain or something, all the way to metaphysical issues. And I think there's something of that. So, for instance, it wonderfully solves, practically solves, the problem of what to do with it, that massive window. Not just the massive window, because we can't afford a great big piece of glass of that size. So you've got this window with the traditional window-like struts, which are extremely domestic. But it solves that by covering over those struts. It solves the problem, this practical problem, because without something like that, the light from the window would permanently silhouette the figure, so that you really wouldn't be able to see the figure. Artworks generally don't do well in terms of natural light. You have to be very careful with natural light, with works of art. They either blind you or they silhouette the figure. So it wonderfully solves that very practical problem of what on earth to do with that window, which I wouldn't have been able to solve, I don't think. Artistically, it's a wonderful solution to the problem of what to do about moving the painting, which so many of us loved very much, which for me was a bit of a revelation seeing that painting. Actually, it was seeing this painting that I first thought, now Arloka has found, after many, many years of working and experimenting, he's found a whole language of his own that does all the things he's trying to do. I felt that very much when I saw this paint, the Vajrasattva. But particularly a lot of people felt that when they saw the Buddha figure. So what the tree does, obviously, is evoke that painting, remind you of that painting, as if that painting has come to life. The painting has literally come to life in front of us. And of course, that's of great, great spiritual significance. So what was 2D is now 3D. What was a picture is now alive amongst us. That's not just an artistic matter, but a spiritual one. But also, and most excitingly, for me, and you know, this is just my reading, is it seems to me to be a wonderful way, a poetic way, an artistic way, of evoking the Dharma Niyama. The Buddha's auras have been transferred into the tree, so he's not got a halo anymore. And with all our associations of the halo in the West, our associations of God with divinity, as if we could become a Buddha, as if Buddhahood is something that you get, like insight is something you get, something you bring into you, something you can achieve. Which is so strongly built into Western assumptions that spiritual life is just more of you, but you just glow a bit more. That the Buddhahood is something you might own, that insight is something you might own, that depth is something you might own. The halo for us could easily be misread into that. So he's given the halo to the tree. The golden radiance of transcendence is given to the tree, to something natural, to something growing, to something rooted, so that the Buddha becomes both human and transcendental. This is Bhante's great point. He says it's not enlightenment that's the great mystery, it's human enlightenment that's the great mystery. That you've got enlightenment, as it were, coming from above, and you've got humanity coming from below, and it's the intersection that's the greatest miracle. And Arloka's Rupa, the whole effect of Arloka's Rupa, is to sort of evoke that meeting of the human and the transcendental, human enlightenment. And of course, that ramifies off in us, for us, with all our understanding of Bhante's vision, Bhante's reiteration of the Buddha's relationship to trees. I remember being very touched by that when I was doing my Mitra study, that the Buddha was born under a tree, died under a tree, gained enlightenment under a tree. Bhante's exquisite sense of what trees mean spiritually, Bhante's exquisite sense that spiritual life is primarily one of growth. And of course that can be misunderstood and trivialised, but it's primarily one of growth. So it seems to me that the aura of transcendence is given to the what grows, to what's rooted. So before I finish, I just want to say something about our locus modernity, you could say. It sounds rather art critical. But for me, one of the most significant aspects of Arlo's work generally is its contribution to a new Buddhist culture is to do with this sense that they are modern. And this is one of the reasons I think why people find them appealing. Some people don't. And that's fine. You don't have to, you know, some people don't. But they are somehow modern. With this rupa and with all the paintings in the room, you feel that there's a reference and a dialogue with 20th century art. At least I feel that, because I know something about 20th century art. Of course, there's lots of other references. Byzantium is particularly always present in Arlo's work. But I'd come to think that the bringing in modern life was impossible for images of the Buddha and for the Bodhisattvas. I had a go myself. I had tried to do this painting, and I just fell back on the sort of Greco-Roman Renaissance thing with a bit of Cezanne mixed in, and I never finished the painting. I really just thought it was impossible to make a modern Buddhist icon, because so much of modernity is to do with anti-spiritual, materialist, nihilist, deconstructionist and all that. So much of 20th century art has been a reaction against the great ideal. Is it usable at all? Now, if you don't use it, you create all sorts of problems, don't you? Because you sort of suggest that anything spiritual is 400 years old at least, or 200 years old at least, which can't be true. If you do use it, you won't run into the problems of those artists' materialism, those artists' deconstruction, and so on. But Arlo's paintings, especially, have a very strong affinity with modern art, particularly with Picasso and Miro, people like that. I think he's very particularly struck by Miro, but I see Picasso and Cubism in the paintings very much. I think, interestingly, that's where, I mean, Arlo might not agree with me. I'm sure we'll be on the phone about this afterwards. He might not agree with almost anything. Anyway, that's fine. But I think particularly the colour of Arlo's paintings comes from Cubism, comes from Picasso. I don't mean borrowed from, but what Picasso does, what modern artists do, one of the things that they achieved were to say, no, folks, this isn't a window into another world. This isn't. We're not doing pretend. We're not saying, look, we're looking into this real space, as the great Renaissance practitioners did, and did wonderfully. He's saying this is a modern artist saying, no, this is a painting. It's a thing on a wall, and it's covered with this stuff called paint. So colour is applied as colour, not as space, if you see what I mean. So if you put red on, it's because it's from a red tube of paint. And that's the point. So when you see Picasso's colour, it's paint, it's stuff. Yeah. One of the attempts of modern art was to, modernist art at least, was to say, look, it's just stuff, and yet this stuff, this paint, these marks on a piece of paper or on a canvas, can create something remarkable. And Arlo is very deep into that that tradition. There's incredible, I think, affinities with that tradition. And as I say, they're not borrowed from it. He's not quoting from it. They're not self-conscious references. They're just part of his blood now. I think for me, it was seeing this painting, I thought, yes, they're now just part, all of those references from Byzantium to Cubism to Miro are just part of his practice, his blood. Yeah, they're just part of his practice as an artist. And you only get there by being in a studio for many, many years. You don't do it any other way. You just have to keep working. And Arlo has worked incredibly hard for many, many, many years. So there's something for me modern about these images. I would never have thought that was possible. I think it's extremely difficult to pull off, and very few people will be able to manage it. So there we are. There's my attempt of a primary reading of my response, in other words, my particular response. And, of course, like your response, my response will change and other associations will gather with it. But there we are. There we have the figure of the Buddha. We have the figure of the Buddha that doesn't fit in with our ways of seeing. That you don't know what to make of it. we have a Buddha that we don't know what to make of, a new figure in an old world, a mysterious figure that doesn't fit in with our preconceptions of what Buddhas should look like, what spiritual figures should look like. We have a figure that's both modern and ancient, both contemporary and timeless. But this timelessness is not expressed in the Greek mode of heroic naturalism, with its tendency to thin into the effete or to become homoeroticized into this sort of narrow vision of beauty. But it's, the timelessness is being evoked by this ancient earth fertility, this symbol of a lingam. It's being evoked in that way. Another reference, just this sparks me off into thinking, that another reference, of this anti-classicism is the evocation of the Buddha's poverty. It's interesting that he's not chosen the high style of Western art, which starts to get very courtly, starts to become associated with money because of the symbolism of the king, I think. So the repudiation is also a repudiation of the world. It's a repudiation of that expensive tradition. So I think the anti-classicism also brings out the Buddha's poverty. And as Banti makes clear, that the Buddha was poor on every level, that poverty is an ideal. The Buddha is utterly unworldly, that his poverty includes not even having a self, never mind anything else. It's the ideal of poverty. And I think this anti-classicism and all the other elements also bring out that aspect of the Buddha. So we have a Buddha that's modern and timeless, a Buddha that doesn't fit in with our preconceptions, a Buddha that is poor in the fully metaphysical sense. He's got poverty in the fully metaphysical sense. A Buddha that is challenging rather than comforting. A figure that challenges us to sit with him, to approach him, to be in the same space with him. A Buddha that challenges us in that way. A Buddha whose room this is. A Buddha who combines divinity with humanity. So he has no halo, no aura of sanctity, but the very tree he sits under glows with transfiguration, with the gold sky of the Dharmadhatu. So you've got a Buddha that is utterly transcendent and yet a natural part of the universe, a natural part of the natural order of things. Ramifying off into all our discussions about the Dharma Nyama, a natural part of the world. You've got a Buddha that combines humanity with the transcendental. A Buddha who writhes with dragon-like energy, and yet is so still, but writhes somehow, turns with dragon-like energy. And it's a dragon-like energy of the awakened one, of the richly endowed. And I think this is the Buddha reimagined.